The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
In Constructing a Nervous System, you write at greater length about what it is to be a woman and to filter your sense of being a woman and being a Black woman. And repeatedly, you look at these different figures in art and they evoke, or in the news, and they evoke these feelings in you. You look at the Tiger Bells and there are these racing greats and you're proud of them, but you're like, oh, they're so muscular. I don't know how I feel about that, because there's this image of who we are as Black women. And is that too muscular? Or you look at Ella Fitzgerald and you love her singing, but you go, oh my God, she's so big and she's sweating. Right. And I was like, you're being so honest, Margo, about what you were feeling and what you were going through.
You know, it was hard sometimes, because, you know, those are not reactions. You know, they're historical, they're social, but they're personal. They're not reactions one is proud of. They're reflections, you know, of all the ways that race, that womanhood, that Black women in particular were being conditioned and trained, you know, so as to get rid of, to keep at a distance, you know, this slew, these centuries of prejudice about, you know, we were basically beasts of burden and labor and sexuality, and we didn't really have brains. And someone like even Ella Fitzgerald, what a wonderful singer, but you know, she's great, but we don't have to talk about, you know, all the craft, all the hard work that went into it. And, you know, no, a singer is not quite as important, you know, as a male instrumentalist. So all of that is circulating around you, even as you're having these pleasures. I adored Tina Turner, but I was very intrigued by the fact that Ike was the man behind the machine, you know, the machine that was the popular machine of Tina and the Ikeettes. He controlled it. So you could be Tina or want to be Tina, but somehow you had to contend with the power of Ike.
You know, you raise that, and repeatedly through the book, as you talk about people in pop culture, you know, various bits of culture, you tell a little bit of the story. And it reminds us to the extent to which what we know of people is so 2D versus 3D, the things we haven't thought about. I had never read anybody, and maybe it's been out there, where somebody said Ike was bipolar. You know, we just always have known him as Mean Ike Turner. Nobody ever stopped and said the man was literally crazy.
The man.
And when you raised that in a different way to look at him, I said, oh.
Right, right. That's one of the ways, I mean, of course, critics have always done interesting biographical and intimate probing work. What I wanted to do was that, you know, take them all a step further. At the same time, I used what I knew about them to probe the history of my own reactions. So often for a critic, your reactions are taken as, you know, as a kind of omniscience. They're a given. But, you know, surely you should be subject, you the critic, should be subject to as many questions and probings about what made you, what created your taste. Why do you take this tone? Why are you pushing away from that, but why are you embracing that? You know, in a way, it's part of our pact with our readers and with the viewers, because all of them are going through exactly the same set of responses. And maybe we all need to play more openly and work more openly with all these contradictory responses we have to this culture that is now, you know, even more around us 24/7, every minute, in every medium and form.
Indeed, that's something to think about. Another area that you come to in the book is you talk about color, which is also something you brought up in Negroland as being hugely important. And you, and again, you were so honest. You're talking about Nina Simone and her talent. And you say, you know, thinking back on Nina Simone in 1959, would I have preferred Miss Simone to be a lighter brown? Yes. It took me back to being a kid with Ebony magazine, and Jane Kennedy was the be all end all in every centerfold. Jane Kennedy with the long flowing hair. And is she black? I don't know.
Exactly.
And your own journey to a moment when you don't realize to see Danai Gurira or Lupita Nyong'o, you know, that when I was a child, that would have never been there. And the interior work you have to do within yourself to undo what you've been told about yourself and in the culture is beautiful. And I would imagine that that is something, as you were writing this book, you were thinking back on. What is it like for you to see that arc from being that little girl going, well, does Nina have to be that dark, to somebody who can walk by these magazines and see us in so many different shades?
Including, does Ella have to be that big? It doesn't matter now. It was
extraordinary. No, Lizzo said it does not.
Lizzo did say, that's right, that's right. And I also cite Mikaela Coelho.
Right.
You know, and because, it, you know, that was the 21st century way of my going, whoa, this is possible now. You know, I have an actual, you know, I have models. It reminds me, that question of yours, which is so astute in the observation. To see all this is to relive and to re-experience the fact that there was a period, and it is the period, I was born in 1947, of both Negroland and this book, when for all the horrors and injustices and bigotries, in many ways, the arc of the moral universe was struggling, you know, to move towards justice. And one felt that, and, you know, just track in our lifetimes, New Left, anti-war, civil rights, Black power, women's movement, gay, as we called it now, queer rights, you know, ethnic, quote, people of color studied, all of that. Yes, there were contentions, all of that, but it was happening. And now, you know, you and I are talking on a morning when it has been made very clear to us again, as it has for some time now, to the extent that major powerful conservative forces can do it, they will ensure that the arc of the Moore universe moves back towards hierarchy, you know, and all kinds of structural bigotries and cruelties. So it's astonishing to just realize in that way, my God, the freedom that the freedoms I was able in my own head as well, because you don't make these kinds of changes, you know, or get these new ways of seeing things unless the world around you is helping offer you that material.
You know, it's interesting that you opened that door to that particular issue, 1973. When Roe passed, who would have thought that we'd be in 2022 talking about a revolution the other way? Does it make you talk a little bit more about that? I mean, you saw so many different revolutions on so many other issues as you're reading that news over your coffee this morning. You know, share with us your thoughts on other things that you feel that you could see start going in different directions that you thought were decided.
Right. Or hoped, at least. You know, look, we've seen it now. If this 4 months ago, 5 months ago, 6 months ago, this story would have been about yet another state confining and cutting off voting rights. Then the story would have become, you know, meaning central news. These stories get sustained. The attack on books, you know, that embody any values, you know, that aren't considered basically patriarchal Christian conservative. So attacks on teachers. Then it has moved to abortion. And what the question I guess we're all grappling with is not only what do we do and how do we do it, but also what happens next? What's the next target of attack? People have said LGBTQ rights. They have talked about interracial marriage being forbidden. It's endless. People have even mentioned, and we know enough about how dystopian fantasies become realities. People have even, all right, what if birth control period becomes illegal, becomes banned. It's like this is a kind of military state, it feels like.
And a lot of people talk about Margaret Atwood. Is there some other author or thing that you find yourself thinking about in this time?
They have been talking a lot about Margaret Atwood. People also still talk about George Orwell, but certainly Octavia Butler.
Octavia.
Yeah. But I must say, I've been more focused just on it's real, it's here.
It's not in a book.
It's in front of me. This is social realism, people.
I want to take it back to your book and the weight of things, because we met your family, your parents, Ronald and Irma, your sister Denise in Negroland, and you talk about them in this book, but in a more elliptical, different way. It's more an anecdote here, a pastiche of this. And with your father at the end of his life, we see him differently here than we do in Negroland. We see the weight of it all at the end of his life, where it's Christmas morning and you all are laughing. And he's saying, it's a bitter dose. It's a bitter dose that in his end days, he's thinking about the weight of everything he lived through as a Black man.
And he's telling seminal, what one could call trauma stories, from his life, the family being run out of this little Mississippi town because they were too outspoken, being not allowed to be in the marching band at the University of Southern California, not being allowed, though he had the grades, to enter their medical school. And it just, it's often you can see a person for many, many years of their life. They are absolutely able to take, the bad things that have happened, to contend with their own terrors and horrors and keep going. And at a certain point, as you get much older, some of those guardrails slip, and this, the material, the water, starts rushing back. And it was too much. My first cousin, interestingly enough, who lives in California, the daughter of his older brother, was reading my book, and she wrote, we grew up differently in many ways, she said, but my father was angry about those early Mississippi days to the end of his life. He was always angry. And I thought, oh, okay. You wouldn't have known for many years with any of them, the doctor, the two judges, but it was all there. These things, they exact a real toll. You're somewhere, unconsciously, consciously, whatever, you're fighting them to rise above them, to best them, to conquer the pain and shame and anger they still rouse the rest of your life. And that's a real historical legacy for us. I don't think, I suffered in the same way. My parents made my life in those ways much easier, but that it has to be recorded.
It does. And it really goes back to the title of the book, Constructing a Nervous System, that in the end, when everything's stripped away, no matter how far you've gone and thought that you've made it past some things, there it is in your nervous system.
That's exactly
at your very core.
And then what do you do with that? So constructing also means, all right, it's at my core. So how do I find a way that's obviously not my father's way and is not my imitating my father's way? How does one find a way to reconstruct, to reconfigure the elements and have them play different roles in your life?
And interestingly enough, in that anecdote, you also talk about your mother, who seems to have a different response. Oh, Ronald, can we just move beyond that?
Talk about the good times.
Right.
It's partly temperamental. It's also true, as my mother did say, she too had a more racially sheltered life. She grew up in St. Louis and Chicago. My father's early years were Mississippi. her family, they were some, well, no, I wouldn't say they were economically better off, but she just was more protected. And maybe, ironically, as a young woman, she was certainly expected to go to college, to, you know, carve out a nice career, but the weight of racial expectations, you must be the symbol that advances the race. It existed for women, but in a certain way, historically, sociologically, that weight was even more on men, I would say, because men were all, you know, in every society, patriarchy means that men are taken more seriously. That has its own prices, which my book is partly about too, the cost if you're a woman, and particularly a Black woman, of being considered second level status, you know, not your destiny, your futures, your possibility for contributions as well as satisfaction. It just doesn't matter as much. That does have its own cost, but I did want to it's important to make those distinctions about how different kinds of historical and sociological and political demands and expectations impose and extract different things according to your generation, your gender, race, color, for that matter, right? And then we could parse it further, easier in terms of color, easier to be darker if you were a man in my day, and probably still in yours. Yeah. Because, you know, what's women crucial? What makes you desirable, right? What are your desirability bona fides?
Right. You know, you talk about it in the opening pages of the book, this decision to do a memoir and to be honest in a memoir. And it's almost like you're interrogating yourself. How honest do you want to be? You know, how is this going to feel? And at one point in the book, you talk about shame, and you say sometimes it's better to be a little ashamed than silent. And I wanted you to talk about that, because it sounds like you really had some moments where you sat down and had to think, what is it to be this honest about my feelings at these various times?
That is one of the many places in the book where I use a quote from another writer. In that case, it's the Polish writer Milosz, to lay forth what I'm going to do. It was absolutely accurate, and it helped embolden me. If it's better to be a little ashamed than silent, then as a writer, you are always asking yourself, what's the price of what I choose to be silent about? You know, particularly as a nonfiction writer, what's the cost to the story I'm telling? If it protects me, does it protect me in an honorable way, or does it, you know, shield me in a somewhat, okay, I don't want anyone to think badly of me way, which is, you know, a little bit vain and cowardly. When I was writing Negroland, I realized, this is a bit of a long way around, but it addresses it, that the part of me that has been a critic, right, of other people's work, of other people's motives, of other people's, their lives insofar as it had to do with their art, that part of me that was crucial to my identity, and I had to turn it on myself. Mm-hmm. I had to turn that capacity for critical analysis and probing and questioning. You're always asking when you see a play or a movie or a TV show, was he being or she being as honest? You know, why did the plot turn that way? What's the hidden agenda, you're often asking. So you can't get away from any of those qualities. You're human, your needs, your compensations, but you can keep showing them, you can keep probing them. And I also wanted, this sounds more selfless than I mean it to be, I wanted my readers, in that way I felt they might trust me more if they saw what kinds of questions and, you know, liabilities I was willing to examine. I also wanted to put them in that atmosphere where that would might be think something they would want to do also, do with me, but also do as themselves.
You know, in the book, you also, in delving into some of these characters, there's a bit where you talk about Willa Cather, mm-hmm. and people maybe think they know her in one way. And with many people, you point out where race is a part of the record. And then you talk about yourself as a teacher. Somebody else might just teach her purely as, let's talk about her journalism or let's talk about her books, but leave this out. And you are determined that you're going to make sure that your students don't walk out with maybe not being a little bit uncomfortable in reading this work. And how does it make them feel? But it made me think as I was reading the book, one thing you didn't talk about is what it meant to be a critic and how many times you must have written a piece and looked at your colleagues' pieces and you realize, hey guys, you left out a whole area here that I must be the only person to see. And I'm going to force everybody to keep coming back to this. Did you decide on purpose not to, in the same way, talk about being a critic?
I didn't exactly. Your probing question. I didn't consciously, actively decide. But I didn't really, I wrote at the very beginning of the book, I referred to, my presence and persona as a critic. You're the first, first Black woman doing this, that, so carry yourself with a certain dignity. I could have taken that further in my journalism, in terms of my critical journalism. And why didn't I? Those weren't entirely the kinds of scores, they partly would have been settling scores. And I actually didn't want to settle them in that way. I wanted to claim, though you're now making me realize that that's as yet an unwritten, perhaps, essay.
There's your title.
There we go. What we leave out. I wanted what I was doing to demonstrate, the range. And the claims I was making. But yes, what we leave out and why, there's a title for the next essay. Yes.
I listened to the podcast between you and Daryl Pinkney, we should tell the listeners that you guys were here together and you said you've stayed friends, because clearly when you listen to it, you can tell you guys really enjoyed being with each other. You had a fascinating conversation at the end where you were talking about young people today. And this move towards wanting to stay with your identity. And he was saying that sometimes he was pushing people, that's great, but you're missing the journey and that tension there. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, we were talking about our mutual friend, Lynette Clementson, and who's also a journalist. We were having this debate about how different it is that when we were young, you were always having to prove, I want to be the Paris bureau chief. I want to be the Tokyo bureau chief. I want to do the White House. And now there's a feeling where you can say, I just want to cover Black folks. That's what I want to do for the next 50 years. And as I listened to your conversation with Daryl, I didn't know how to feel about it. Like, as you think of that conversation and this book, do you agree with this idea of so many people now that a young Margot Jefferson would say, I'm just going to be critical of Black stuff. I'm just going to talk about Black stuff all day long versus the Daryl Pinkney view of, yeah, but Margot, maybe you could go look at some of this other stuff too. I find that I'm still trying to work it out. How would I feel if I was a young journalist today? And I just said, I just want to cover Black stuff.
Well, if you even in quote, my day, that expression, you were making choices. If, for example, I had been at the Village Voice, like say Tulani Davis and Stanley Crouch and Greg Tate were. They wrote very regularly, sometimes exclusively, about Black culture, Black art, all of the Black arts, Black literature, Black history. I chose to go to places like Newsweek. I wrote for The Voice, but I freelanced for places from Vogue to The Nation. And when I went to Newsweek, I thought to myself, okay, what are my choices? I can, because this was the early 70s and you could definitely carve out a career, even at a mainstream white publication, as largely the Black critic. And I thought, I've got several tasks here that I want to do. I want to bring the work of Black people of color, international writers. I was a book reviewer then. I want to do that. I want to bring women. I want to help create these canons. And I also want to continue because this is part of my education and it's part of what I care about in terms of culture, to write about any white subject, including white, male, heterosexual, that I wish. And I am going to carve out my career on all of those fronts. It is possible. Daryl did the same thing. You know, Daryl has written consistently and wonderfully about Black literary traditions and about other things. So I think it's partly, if the journalism and social, you know, and historical environment and political is offering you those options, I think it's fantastic if you can choose.
You know,
according to your temperament, your needs, your passions and interests. It was important for me in this book to do a lot of cross-cultural mixing in all of those ways, because I didn't want this is white, this is Black binary or division to just dominate the book. I wanted that sense of now you're here, now you're there. This is, this matters to you terribly. And it's Paul Muni in a 30s Hollywood movie. Oh, okay. You know, there's Etta James, you know, becoming a style role model. I wanted people to have that sense of, even when it contradicted and bubbled and, you know, of plenitude.
And
in themselves too.
Listen, I'm here for it because that's the way I lived my life. But, you know, it's interesting that you felt you had the choice. I don't think I felt that I had the choice.
You're the next generation.
Yeah.
From me. So you felt that your choice had to be what?
I was at Time and then I was in TV, that we were made to feel that the standard was having to prove that we could break barriers, that we could hold the role that a white man could hold, that we could be the senior editor at Time, that we could be the editor in chief, that we could be, you know, the White House correspondent, that we could hold these roles. And we had to show that breadth and that authority, that we couldn't do something that I look at young journalists today where they can say, there is a wealth of stuff over here, and I just want to focus here because we've been left outside the frame, and I intend to make this my entire frame now.
There's one difference that you can make that choice. This is my entire frame, race,
right,
gender, within worlds, mainstream, journalism worlds. Those choices were not there in the same way for you.
They were not.
Yeah.
They were not
going to be able to claim that authority. Look at someone like Dean Baquet, who's about to retire, you know, but he did all of that. You know, he did the Black credibility, he did the Times journalist credibility. But the changing media landscape. Now you can write so much, say, just at the Times about Black culture, and you know, not in more than one could when I was there.
So progress, when we look at Jelani Cobb or Ta-Nehisi Coates or Aaron Haynes or many other young.
Doreen Saint-Philly, television, yeah. But you fold, they are all folding, you know, the white, the Black, what we would have once called white material and Black material, they're folding.
And people from all over are looking at all the material, which is wonderful.
Yes, and knowing they have to learn anew. Yeah.
In both books, you talk a little bit about depression. Mm-hmm. You don't dwell, you don't stay there long, you just touch on it in each one. And I wanted to definitely hit on that because we are in Mental Health Awareness Month. How did you think out the degree to which you wanted to talk about it and what that meant to you? I mean, I thought that could have been a book within itself. Because depression is something you wrestle with your whole life. It's not, you know, an afternoon or a summer.
No.
How did you decide?
I did talk about it more in Negroland because I never had before. I decided to, it really mattered to me to talk about it because I wanted, as again, more in Negroland I talk about, to help break that that taboo. In a sense, which says, you know, Black people are supposed to be stronger. We're not, it's shameful in some way. It shows a kind of possible concession to racial defeat or self-hatred to fall into, to acknowledge. We have to be almost superhuman in our strength to keep battling racism. I wanted to really break that. Fortunately, I had models and I wanted to track it through into Saki Shange and Adrienne Kennedy and Nella Larson. So I made it a kind of almost version of emotional awakening to pain and crisis that I could name through Black women artists who had done it before. So I kind of wanted to establish a legacy for Black women of acknowledging that and then finding ways through it. I think the book ends with my going to my my therapist and my psychopharmacologist. I think it's, I talk about it less here, but I think, you know, the mood swings of the book actually make it actually very clear that's, you know, that's very much something I'm contending with and going through. You know, again, that's another kind of piece one might write, the history of my, in my case, I would also say I wasn't really aware of—
Wait, say that again?
I wasn't really aware in my own life of how depressed I was until college and right after. So it took me a while, you know, as a young woman, especially in New York, I started thinking with the help of friends of, you know, how do I find a therapist? How do I— not an accident that, you know, Black feminism was starting at that time and we were examining ourselves and our vulnerabilities. Not an accident that, you know, all parts of the women's movement emphasize the personal is political. The personal is also personal. You know?
Right.
You can't do the political unless you're caring for and tending to and attending to the personal. So and that really was, anyway, enough.
But I was just going to tell people who are watching that you really do talk about life in split screen, that on one hand, people could look at you and go, oh my God, she's such a success. She's achieving so much. Meanwhile, you literally are thinking about suicide and practicing putting your head in the oven and going, oh God, I got a crick in my neck. We're going to do something else. but that it was this weighty thing. And, you know, as maybe it's because I so recently read Negroland, you know, it reminded me of the degree to which race sometimes is almost like wallpaper or white noise, that it's this thing, it's like a bee that's in your ear and it's constantly there. And I'm looking at young Margot and she's just trying to figure out these thick glasses she's wearing and where she fits in. And is she going to be a cheerleader? And here's this other thing.
Or am I going to be an artistic type?
Right. Right. What's going to happen? Where do I fit in? And when you start talking about the depression, the degree to which it would have come anyway, and then how much of it was this constant innervating buzz that was just a weight on your little shoulders from the very beginning, how much of it was related to that?
How do you— they all contending forces, right?
Right.
Contending and conjoining. It would suggest, the way you have put it, that, you know, mental health is something that people of color, need to really tend to seriously and vigilantly, you know, as part of, you know, how we care for ourselves and how we make the most of ourselves without sacrificing, you know, in independence, in vulnerability, risk-taking.
And it's a lot. It is a lot. It's— I wanted to ask you about the organization of the book, because, you know, Negroland is chronological, talking about from being a little girl up through as you get older. Constructing a Nervous System, sometimes it's like a play, sometimes it's like essays, sometimes it's like anecdotes and remembrances. How did you decide on this particular structure in writing this memoir?
It was hard, but I kept going back to, what do I mean by constructing a nervous system? You know, our nervous system has all of these different elements that operate. I mean, the biological one, separately, but somehow they cohere, they take care of different functions. I thought, you know, you can track one very individually. Oh, this, you know, that's doing that with the neurotransmitters. No, this is regulating the blood. And I thought, okay, that's how I have to keep treating this material. These materials, plural, everything is plural. Something I had done in Negroland, but not as much as I wanted to also, was really just play with or work with different forms. Like you name them, there's a sort of theater address, there's monologue, there's dialogue, there's confession, there's drama, there's a certain amount of argument. Also, I felt what I wanted to keep doing more here, which I felt was very, very characteristic of the way I grew up and you grew up too. You're playing roles all the time. They aren't necessarily, all of them aren't uncomfortable for you, but you are assigned certain roles. This is the good student. This is the good Black party girl. This is the girl who's going to the integrated party. this is the cheerleader. This is Etta James, right? So you're always doing that. This is how I behave around my grandparents. This is how constant. It's very performative growing up in the world we grew up in.
And that work of trying to figure out which one is your truest self as you try on all these personas.
Exactly, with the white noise coming up. Right. Exactly. And maybe more than one is your true self, but then how do they operate together? And which ones, if they're not your true self, which ones are really harming you?
Now that's a deep question. Figuring out which ones to put in a box and retire.
That's right.
We have a question that's come in. Somebody says, what activity or experience is your favorite way to soothe your nervous system?
Always some form of listening to some chosen piece of music. Might be in my house, it might be going to a concert, it might be going to a club, but I can always, putting my little phones in, I can always count on some setting in which I can pick or am struck by some piece of music. So I would say that's my go-to always, alone and with other people.
And, I wonder, what do you think of modern criticism? Like, as you read what's out there now, because you've seen an evolution of the art form from the time you got into it to now, do you look and you like what you see? I mean, one of the things that makes me sad is every newspaper used to have a book critic. Magazines had book critics. Book criticism was just this paragon that we looked up to. And now if you don't have a subscription to the New York Review of Books or read the Times, so many great papers no longer have it. And maybe you can find little corners of it online. What are your thoughts on modern criticism, in particular book criticism?
Well, it's been squeezed much more into a corner. There is still some very good stuff appearing, in magazines that have been around for years, but also in places like Slate, for example, mm-hmm. or The Root. It's there, but there's not a question that literary criticism in books have been trying to fight off the onslaught of first movies, theater, movies, television, not so much theater, but movies, television, now every form of media. And I would like, because we are readers, we have our little, all our devices that we read on, it's not just, I have to go to a bookstore. I'd like to see more of it, but it has to contend with all of these other forms of criticism, which are actually, what I'm more worried about is the distinction between really lively, vivid, passionate criticism and, the online version of, I love it, I hate it, I'm going to say something cute, pay attention to me because I'm really funny. That's what's tiresome.
That's pretty much Twitter in a nutshell.
There are some writers who will use Twitter to to also retweet in longer articles and such, but that way madness lies where Twitter's going to go.
You in this book write a lot about race and about spaces. What are your thoughts on the current debate about who can write about what and whom? Pamela Paul last week in the Times made an argument for everybody ought to be able to write whatever they want. as any gender, any race, any what have you. Some people would say, stay out of that thicket. What are your thoughts?
Well, she, as I recall, she was talking a lot about fiction, but my feeling is, or my opinion is, if you are going to, and this probably comes from my being a critic and knowing I can't just walk into, you know, a play or, you know, or read someone who's written 12 books, new book, and not do any research on them. I mean, you have to inform and educate yourself about what you're writing. So if you are going to take on a character of a very different social circumstance, race, gender, then the minimum you have to do is a kind of, you know, submerging yourself in a cultural, a historical, and emotional education. You know, if you're really deeply going to do that. I don't like to forbid groups or individuals belonging to groups in advance from taking on something, but I would like there to be more guardrails and scruples. What I'd love to get rid of is that sort of historical, almost blind arrogance. Of course I can do this, you know, I impersonate this other. Of course I can take, I'm interested in race and gender. I can figure this out. No, you can't. So, and also maybe you find your way into it step by step. You know,
right. It's funny because that reminded me of a line you had in the book about Bing Crosby. I'm Bing Crosby. I can get away with anything. I'm entitled to everything.
That's right. That's the dream. And for a few sacred few, including George Bush, whom I also mentioned, Junior, that's the sacred dream of unquestioned, unchallenged, white heterosexual patriarchy. And you know, there it is. So
there's another,
you should never have that frame of mind if you're going to move into someone else's reality. Yeah. And take extra time if you're going to try to do it.
There's another question that's come in. Somebody said, since writing this book, do you find yourself being more mindful about the people you meet? Do you think about how they will affect you?
You meet people I meet.
Maybe they meant like people you let into your world, realizing that your nervous system is affected by the things that you take in. Are you more mindful, I guess, about who's in your spaces?
I think I've always been mindful about that. You know, I think you become more self-conscious when you've published a book because you're also thinking, you know, what about the people you encounter who are who've read the book and are reacting to the you that they saw in that book. So I think that form of awareness, of caution, maybe. I would say. But I've always, you know, I've lived alone much of my adult life, most of my adult life. So I'm very aware of how you protect and curate your own space.
Are you still in New York or did you go back to Chicago, which is your hometown? Had you thought about that?
Not really. Once my, Denise and I were hellbent on going to New York, you know, to be in the arts. And our parents actually encouraged that. But once we both settled in New York and then once both my parents had died, I do still have friends there. But, it wouldn't be the same. Yeah.
It's the people, not the place. And in fact, I'm glad you said that because that is an aspect of constructing a nervous system, which is grappling with life as being the one who's still here. Your sister passed, your parents passed. You imagine your mother in the beginning of the book thinking on your sister who's not there. And I should ask you a little bit about that and what thinking about that went into putting together this book.
Oh, I had not quite realized since it's been, you know, some years now, the extent to which the shock of being the orphan of that original nuclear family. Luckily, I have a niece, a great niece, a nephew-in-law, that I'm in a different position vis-a-vis them. I was the youngest child in this particular family. And you remember thousands, millions of things once you've lost your parents. Some of them are pleasant, some of them are not, but so many details come back to you that you realize are you know, just like you're part of your skin, part of your body and bones. My sister was the big shock. We were 3 years apart, and I just never thought I'd be without her till we were safely in our 90s. Even though I didn't keep talking about it, just taking in both their loss and their intensity, their effect on me. I hadn't written so intimately about my father before, but I wanted to to put that on record. Yeah.
Do you find that
it's an elegy in some ways, the book? Yeah.
Do you find that you still think about yourself on a daily, regular basis in the mirror of Denise? Because in both books, you know, which character from Little Woman are you? She gets to pick first, and then you pick one of the other ones. Dorothy Dandridge or Lena Horne? She is your bookend. She is your mirror. Being her little sister is a fundamental part of who you are. Do you find that you're still in that conversation even after these years have passed?
I'm still in that memory zone. Not always in the conversation, because sometimes the conversation was, no, you do this and I do that. And that's much less true now. But I re-experience things I experienced with her, and I experience how she might have responded to things. And that tickles me. She does remain from a little more from a distance, but a mirror, a reflection, and just an acute source. I now feel that, siblings, they matter. There is much a profound primal influence on you, especially if you're a younger one than as your parents. So, she's everywhere.
And I would urge people, as much as I would urge them, to read everything you can find with Margo Jefferson's name on it. Also look up Denise Jefferson, beautiful dancer, leader at Alvin Ailey, created quite the legacy. And my goodness, both of you, beautiful through the decades, just watching her stand there, the line of her stance is incredible.
That's so nice. Her daughter, I must say, her daughter Francesca,
gorgeous dancer,
also
too.
A dancer, and now the head of Alvin Ailey too. The sex, so
the legacy goes on.
Legacy, yes.
Somebody writes, do you have any advice for ignoring all of the news and noise and not letting it into your nervous system? I don't know. I said to somebody today, I'm moving to New Zealand and not taking a TV.
Those are the extreme and probably the only fully successful measures. What I find I'm doing, which other friends are saying also, we monitor not only how late we watch the news, but how many hours or even minutes of it we do.
Right.
It's like taking your temperature. There's certain things we have to keep up with. But when the, I'm not in good health right now. I don't need that third hour. And then you find, and the same thing can happen reading the newspaper. Then you find, what is it that I need to regenerate, to calm? Maybe it's food.
Yeah.
Maybe it's going out for a drink with a friend. Maybe it's whatever. But you do that. This is all about self-care as well as the horrors. As we take it in, we can't be overwhelmed. We have to find ways not to be drowned by it.
Are you reading as much as you did when you were regularly having to turn in criticism, or you've taken a break from it? And if you are reading as much, I want to steal Ezra Klein's question, which I think is the best part of his podcast, which is he says to people, give me three books. And so when you have a book critic like Margo Jefferson, you should say, give me three books.
Oh, well, I just wrote a few months ago, and I'm still happy with the original book. I wrote an introduction for Gwendolyn Brooks's only novel, Maud Martha. And it was wonderful to reread it. That was a great, great, great pleasure. And let's see, three books. Well, you know, I always go back and reread Emily Dickinson. She's often by, you know, so we've got two poets, but one, her, the novel, one, Emily. I think that'll do. I think the two for now will do. I read a lot of stuff, but kind of quickly and in a more scattered way than I would like. Partly I'm reading what I'm teaching, which is, you know, often essays, critical essays, memoir mm-hmm. essays. I don't read as consistently, you know, I read more randomly than I used to. Maybe that's not a bad thing.
No, I don't think it is at all. And you know, no sooner do you meet somebody than they say, are you getting married? No sooner do you get married than they say you're having a baby. No sooner do you have a baby than they say you're having another baby. So you've written this book. Are you going to write another book? Do you have any thoughts on what that would be?
I do, but I'm thinking about, a friend and I are thinking about, we might start with essays. We want to kind of look at historically and in terms of our timeline, which started really in post-war. What are the demands? What are the conditions of how are, you know, friendship is so important for women now. How, what is interracial friendship ask of you, demand of you? What kinds of prohibitions might it set up that you have to get around? So I'm interested in that subject, which also has to do with being, a single woman who's created a family through friends and a very varied one. I don't want to use the word diverse. I'm so tired of it. when are you kind of the powerful one? When do you have to learn something? How do all those power dynamics of race and class shifted and sorted through in interracial friendships?
I think that is a great issue, topic, question. I think so many of us are in that space and trying to navigate it. So I say go forward with all speed. And hopefully I get to talk to you about that one as well. Margo Jefferson, it has been a joy to get to spend this hour with you and to have gotten a chance to sit with your work. If people are feeling enervated out there right now, sit down with Constructing a Nervous System or Negro Land and let yourself be transported. So thank you again.
Thank you. You are terrific.
That's high praise, and I will take it on a Wednesday afternoon.
Yeah.
Be well and keep writing.
Thank you, my dear. Okay.
All right. Thank you to all of you who joined us here in this lunchtime hour.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.